Today is Thursday, March 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Our top story today, COVID-19 cases spike in India and France.
The numbers, however, spiked sharply to 30 this week, and it has created huge concerns.
Plus, tens of thousands of refugees are stuck between Turkey and Greece, and activists say U.S. President Donald Trump's wall along the Mexico border is destroying fragile habitats. Those stories and more are next. Our top story today is the COVID-19 outbreak. In France, cases jumped by 92 Thursday to 377. There have also been two more deaths, bringing the national total to six. Here's journalist Nicolas Pinault in Paris.
I was informed this morning, I've already briefed the president. This is a person who had traveled to Italy, and they were a group of 10, and so they returned a few.
Sorry, that was some technical difficulties. Here is journalist Nicolas Pinault in Paris.
French authorities, they're trying to reassure people, trying to reassure the population that everything is under control. But as of right now, they're not going to close any school or colleges like they did in Italy. And the main concern right now, there is a huge political event in France next week, elections for city hall, for mayors. So far, authorities, they have been saying this election will take place in France.
That was journalist Nicolas Pinault in Paris. And also in South Africa, that country has announced its first confirmed case of the new coronavirus. Health Minister Zwelithini Mkhize said a 38-year-old man from KwaZulu-Natal province had returned this week from Italy with his wife and other travelers. A health team is now getting in touch with all the people he had contact with. South Africa is the first country in Southern Africa and the third in Sub-Saharan Africa to register a case of COVID-19. To date, seven countries in Africa have recorded cases. Besides South Africa, they are Algeria, Senegal, Egypt, Nigeria, Morocco, and Tunisia. Briefing South Africa's parliament in Cape Town on the new case Thursday, the health minister of South Africa said the man is being treated and is in isolation.
I was informed this morning, I've already briefed the president. This is a person who had traveled to Italy, and they were a group of 10, and so they returned a few days ago. But the patient had consulted a general practitioner who was, because of the level of collaboration, was aware of the protocol that we have to take. Patient had presented with fever, headaches, malaise, and sore throat, not much of a cough. And in the process, they took the specimen, and then they got the laboratory informed. And this has been tested positive.
Meanwhile, India's COVID-19 cases jumped from 3 to 29 today, including 16 Italian tourists. Earlier, I spoke to journalist Anjana Pasricha in New Delhi for the latest.
Well, you know, a week back, we only had three people who were infected, and that was in a southern state, and those people were also cured. So I think there was a fair amount of comfort in the country that India is safe. The numbers, however, spiked sharply to 30 this week, and it has created huge concerns. More than half of them, of course, are Italian tourists, and they have been put in isolation wards. The Indians who have contracted the infection are mostly those who have traveled overseas recently or their family members. Now, the number of 30 does not seem very high compared to several other countries, and considering India is a country of 1.3 billion people. But, you know, the concerns about the virus are especially high in India because of factors such as a very high population density. Low-income settlements in Indian cities can be very crowded. The possibility of its rapid spread does exist and does loom on the country.
How have the authorities reacted? What is their response so far to ensure that this doesn't spread further?
Well, India has been fairly alert. And, you know, they have bought surveillance at all airports to check passengers, but I think this was limited to 12 countries. Now they say they will increase it to all passengers who are coming from outside because so many tourists were found to be infected. And also the Indians who have been tested positive had also traveled from outside. The number of laboratories to test the virus has been increased. Isolation wards have been set up in government hospitals to take care of people who are catching the infection. Primary schools have been shut only in the Indian capital, not in the entire country. That's purely as a precautionary measure because one student was found to be infected earlier this week. And there is a huge effort to track down all people who came in contact with those who have contracted the coronavirus. Not an easy task.
And those tourists, what's happened to them? Are they quarantined now or have they been sent back to Italy?
No. They've been put in quarantine. They are in a hospital in close to New Delhi, on the outskirts of New Delhi, all of them.
India is the world's largest producer of generic medicine. How is this impacting the industry there? And with the outbreak now in India, are there any extra measures being taken by this industry?
Well, you know, the measures that are being taken by the industry are purely kind of looking at the stocks they have, how long they can produce the medicines, and the government is monitoring it very closely. So now the pharma industry says that they do have enough stocks for about 2 months. But they are very worried about the fact that supply chains have been disrupted and that chain factories are not producing because all the raw pharmaceutical ingredients, about 70% of them, India imports from China, and the ships have not been coming in. Smaller manufacturers say they've already been impacted by price hikes and it may not be viable for them to produce some of the common drugs any longer because, you know, medicine prices are controlled in India. So there is some concern. The government, however, says there is no need to panic. I think they also restricted the exports of 26 medicines and pharmaceutical ingredients this week, primarily to protect domestic stocks. This, however, could impact countries that were importing from India. And among the items that they have sort of clamped down on are paracetamol and some essential antibiotics.
That was journalist Anjana Pasricha in New Delhi. Now, healthcare workers are on the front lines of fighting the COVID-19 outbreak, but how can they stay safe? University of Minnesota Duluth professor Dr. Jeremy Yude explained to me earlier today.
Healthcare workers are on the front line, and that makes them particularly vulnerable to contracting these sorts of infectious diseases. This is part of the reason why it's so important that people not panic by, say, going out and buying up all sorts of masks, because that limits the availability of those respiratory masks for healthcare workers who actually would benefit from being able to have access to them. So a lot of it is about just making sure that there are these sorts of facilities available, these sorts of containment measures, and these sorts of protection materials available for healthcare workers. And that may also involve cooperating across different state lines or even across national lines so that supplies can get to those areas where they are most needed. If and when there are these outbreaks among healthcare workers, this is where I think it's going to be really important to see where there can be opportunities for cooperation, not just between healthcare facilities, but also, say, working with non-governmental organizations or other groups that may have some expertise that can go in and can help to augment those healthcare workers and make sure that care can still be provided in those communities. The last thing that I think is absolutely vital, though, is paying attention to the healthcare workers, making sure that their voices are being heard and that their concerns are being listened to. They can be really effective advocates for themselves about what sorts of supplies they need, what sorts of resources are necessary for them to be able to do their jobs. When we've seen healthcare workers feel like their voices haven't been heard or that government officials aren't paying attention to them, we've seen healthcare workers say, well, I'm not going to work then. I'm not going to put myself and potentially my family at risk. And that just exacerbates these sorts of outbreaks.
And that was something that happened early on in this outbreak in Hong Kong, where for a period of time, a number of doctors downed their tools because they felt the Hong Kong government wasn't restricting travel enough from China.
Right. And again, this is where that communication and that trust becomes so important, that there's a good line of communication between those frontline healthcare workers and the policymakers who are making these decisions, but also that both sides feel like they can trust each other and that their voices are going to be heard and that they can then implement policies that are going to be rational and effective and have buy-in from various communities.
Last of all, you talk about this need for trust and also for these different organizations to be working together. Now that this is quite clearly a global outbreak, how do you think the global community is doing in terms of coordinating? Obviously, there's the WHO, then there are plenty of other national organizations as well as non-governmental organizations. Are you seeing right now the kind of level of global coordination that is needed to bring this under control?
In the early days, the international community kind of missed a step. They missed an opportunity to really get on this as quickly as they could. In more recent days, I think we have seen WHO and other organizations taking a more active and aggressive approach. Now, WHO is limited in terms of what it's able to do. It's not able to actually deploy a lot of healthcare workers itself, but it can provide this really important repository of information, sharing and disseminating that information, and bringing together these different parties so that we all have a common set of knowledge that we can use to build policy. So I think things are starting to move in the right direction, but that doesn't mean that we can just rest on our laurels. It doesn't mean that everything is fine. And we have seen some disagreements among various national governments about their willingness to share information or to cooperate with other countries. And the important thing with an outbreak like this that is clearly on a worldwide scale is that no country is going to be able to handle it on its own. Even if you're, if a country is doing everything that it thinks is going to be effective within its own borders, what we've seen very clearly is that it only takes one or two people who may have traveled to another country and inadvertently bring the virus back with them, and you can have another flare-up happening in that country. So there has to be this global cooperation that has to be at the forefront.
That was University of Minnesota Duluth Professor Dr. Jeremy Ude speaking to me earlier. Judges at the International Criminal Court, or ICC, ruled Thursday that prosecutors can go ahead with an investigation into atrocities committed by all parties in the war in Afghanistan. Gambian prosecutor Fatou Bensouda wants to look more closely at the actions of U.S. forces, Afghan forces, and Taliban fighters during the conflict that began in 2001. Both the United States, which is not a member of the World Court, and Afghanistan objected to the court's action, but human rights groups applauded the move. And in the U.S., Senator Elizabeth Warren, the left-wing firebrand who emerged as a top Democratic contender for the White House, said that she would, ended her campaign on Thursday. That's according to reports from the New York Times and the Associated Press. Warren, 70, was the last woman among the top tier of Democrats in a field that began as the most diverse in history. And Peruvian diplomat Javier Perez de Cuellar, the United Nations' first Latin American-born Secretary General, died Wednesday at the age of 100. Elected to Secretary General in 1981, he went on to negotiate an end to the 10-year war between Iran and Iraq, help broker Namibia's independence from South Africa in 1990, and broker an end to conflicts in Cambodia, Nicaragua, and El Salvador. This is VOA. Now, in the last 6 months, the U.S. has significantly expanded its wall along the border with Mexico following orders from President Donald Trump. But environmental activists say the construction is ruining fragile desert ecosystems and pushing rare species toward extinction. Earlier, I spoke with the Center for Biological Diversity's Lakin Jordahl, who is in the Arizona desert.
So in the last few months, kind of across the whole border of Arizona, we've seen a huge amount of new border wall construction happening in protected wildlife refuges and national monuments. We're seeing a huge amount of land be bulldozed, all of these ancient cactuses actually be uprooted and chopped up. And we're also seeing Border Patrol use millions and millions of gallons of groundwater to mix concrete for the border wall. So all of these beautiful areas along the border are just being decimated by wall construction right now.
Can you describe this desert landscape? What does it look like? And you know, what are the wildlife and the plants that are there?
So the Arizona borderlands, the only place in the country, in the United States, where two species of cactus grow. They're these incredible, almost tropical species of cactus. And you have an entire ecosystem of unique wildlife that revolves around this specific area of Sonoran Desert. We have this endangered pronghorn species. It's actually the smallest species of pronghorn on the continent.
And that's an antelope, the pronghorn?
Correct, yeah, it's a pronghorn antelope. There's an incredible freshwater spring on the border, just a few hundred feet north of the actual border, home to an endangered pupfish and an endangered freshwater turtle. And it's the only place in the world where these two species live. So we're extremely concerned that wall construction and the water usage for the wall could actually drive these species to extinction.
Now, normally when you think of a government project, usually there has to be some sort of environmental impact assessment or some sort of process to make sure that the construction doesn't impact endangered species and critical fragile habitats like this. Was that done at all with the wall construction?
To rush this project, the Trump administration has waived every single relevant environmental law. They have cast aside all of the most important environmental protections on the books. We are challenging this waiver of law in court, but at the moment, while our case works its way through the court system, a huge amount of irreversible damage is being done. Normally, anytime the government wants to do a big project like this, they would have to do an environmental assessment. They would have to consider the impacts of the projects on endangered species, on Native American burial grounds. And we're very fearful that the desert may never recover here because of all the damage that's being done.
You mentioned Native Americans. This wall is being built in part on lands that are claimed by the Tohono O'odham tribe in Arizona. How are they reacting to this construction?
So a huge amount of this construction is happening on land that was Tohono O'odham ancestral homelands. They have been removed from some of these areas, but the tribe still actively uses a lot of this desert for ceremonies, for plant gathering. Most of southern Arizona is O'odham land, and there are numerous archaeological sites, burial sites, really important cultural sites that are now being destroyed by this wall construction. The Tohono O'odham, their territory spans both sides of the border, so this wall is being built right through the heart of their territory. It's cleaving their homeland in two, and it's also destroying a lot of their cultural history. The tribe has been unilaterally opposed to this project. They passed a resolution against the wall in 2017. The tribal chairman actually testified in front of Congress just last week. But as things currently stand, they're speaking out, and they're speaking out strongly, but the government's just not listening to their concerns. And we're seeing a huge amount of cultural history be destroyed.
There are other residents who are not tribal residents in the area. What are these residents feeling about the wall?
Well, there's a really interesting phenomenon here. And basically, the closer you get to the actual border, the more you meet people who oppose the wall. I think the push, the craze to build this wall comes from people who have never been to the border. And most communities along the border are opposed to this project. In fact, 39 different communities in the borderlands have passed resolutions opposing the border wall.
That was the Center for Biological Diversity's Lycan Jordan, who is in the Arizona desert. The Turkish and Russian presidents are set to hold talks in Moscow aimed at ending hostilities in northwest Syria. Moscow backs Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, while Ankara has supported his foes throughout the 9-year civil war. But as Syria's government launched a Russia-backed offensive to regain control over Idlib province, which is the last rebel stronghold, Turkey has sent thousands of troops to block the operation. Ankara is also calling for a no-fly zone and a de-escalation zone in the area. The Syrian offensive has pushed nearly a million people toward Turkey, which already hosts about a million Syrian refugees. The Turkish government fears another influx if Assad's forces capture Idlib. To push the West to offer more support both for refugees in Turkey and for Turkey's goals in Idlib, Turkey opened its border with Greece this week, prompting tens of thousands of refugees in Turkey to attempt to cross into Europe. But Greek authorities have blocked them. For more, I spoke with journalist Dorian Jones in Istanbul.
Well, the situation on the Greek border has witnessed more violent confrontations between the thousands of refugees trying to enter Greece and being pushed back by Greek security forces. There have been a number of serious injuries in the past few days as tensions have been rising. Greece has been adamant it will not allow anyone into its country illegally, not even to declare asylum, which human rights groups say could violate international law. On the Turkish side, President Tayyip Erdogan not backtracking on his decision to keep Turkish borders open for all those who have sought refuge in Turkey and who want to leave to enter Europe, either through neighbouring Greece or Bulgaria. He says simply that Turkey cannot no longer sustain hosting around 4 million refugees, says the country, will not take any more, and it's up to Europe to share this responsibility. Ankara is believed to be using the refugee crisis on Europe's borders as leverage on European NATO members to push them to create this safe haven in Idlib, which would be protected by a no-fly zone, and which Ankara say would guarantee that there would be not another exodus of 1, possibly 2 million Syrians into Turkey, which Turkey has said if that happens, that will be Europe's problem as well.
You've said that there's a concern of a million or more who are stuck in Idlib. Are they more or less able to cross that border still, or has that border opened? And then second of all, are they heading straight for Europe where this confrontation has been taking place with Greece, or are these other refugees who have been essentially languishing in Turkey for years after fleeing their homes?
Turkey has sealed its border with Idlib. It has built a large concrete barrier that runs along that frontier. There is already around 1 million, maybe more than 1 million, already massed on Turkey's frontier. If Damascus was to overrun Idlib, then even Ankara, I think, would say that they would struggle to stop those people from surging into Turkey. Now, if that was to happen, President Erdogan has made it very clear, Turkey will not stand in their way of them moving on into Greece. It's a very narrow boat trip across between Turkey and Greece to the Greek islands. In 2015, over 1 million refugees entered Greece and neighboring Bulgaria. And the ones that have been moved into the Greek and Bulgarian border are those that have been here for many years. It's not just Syrians, there are Afghanis, Iranians, even Africans. And Ankara says Turkey can no longer cope. It said its costs in the region of $40 billion.
There have been some very disturbing images coming out lately, some of course from Syria, where people are truly suffering in Idlib amid all this violence, but then also some very disturbing images coming out from the Greece-Turkey border. There's been reports of tear gas, there have been videos showing Coast Guard pushing back and even shooting on small rubber boats carrying refugees. How much longer can the European Union hold this very hard line against unarmed people who have essentially fled war?
This crisis was waiting to happen. It was only a matter of when, not if. Turkey says a lot of the promises in that refugee deal that was agreed in 2016 haven't been honored. They say that they're still owed around 3 billion euros. And the Ankara says is unless there's actually a crisis on Europe's border, Europe shows little interest of addressing its concerns. And that's one of the factors why Erdogan says he has created this crisis, because it's the only way of getting Europe's attention. And similarly from the Greece's perspective too, they have been struggling with steadily growing flow of migrants. It too claims that Europe is not sharing the resources to help it deal with this problem. And again, there is this criticism too that Brussels has been largely ineffective in dealing with this ongoing refugee crisis. And the result is that we now have this situation where we see tens of thousands of people along the Greek border being shot at with tear gas, stun grenades, casualties.
That was journalist Dorian Jones in Istanbul. Now, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is struggling to build a governing coalition even after beating his challenger, former Chief of Staff Benny Gantz, in Monday's elections, which were the country's third in a year. Mr. Netanyahu is Israel's longest-serving prime minister, but he is only three seats short of forming a government coalition. Exit polls on Monday night had originally given Netanyahu's right-wing and religious bloc 60 seats out of the total 120 seats in the Knesset, which is Israel's parliament, but final results have changed that picture. In many ways, it is similar to the two previous elections this year, with no party having a way to form a majority coalition. Mr. Netanyahu did bounce back from the last election, with his Likud party becoming the largest, and Israel's president, Reuven Rivlin, is expected to offer him the chance to form a government. But Mr. Netanyahu insisted he had won big, despite three indictments on corruption charges. His trial is scheduled to start on March 17th. He said that Israelis gave him more votes for prime minister than anyone in Israel's history, and said that the election was a knockout. Mr. Netanyahu also accused Gantz of trying to undermine the results of the election by pushing forward a law that would make it illegal for a prime minister to continue to serve while under indictment. Now, analysts say it will not be easy to pass that law quickly, and it is not likely to affect the prime minister right now. For example, Israeli journalist Amit Asel says that although Mr. Netanyahu won, he still has a long road ahead of him. He described this as not being a true landslide. Now, if Netanyahu will try to get at least three members of his center-left bloc to change sides and support his government, but a number of analysts have said that that is also not likely. That's going to do it for us today. You have been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Nadia Taha, and our engineer, Nashwan Kala, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Have a great day.